are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents and students worldwide.
One of the big challenges with a merger is, or an acquisition, is kind of how do you create a shared culture? How do you move knowledge around between these two newly joined organisations? And one of the key findings for me is that it's about a kind of having a long view of how long that takes, probably starting more with what's called the sociocultural integration. So building the kind of trust, the shared kind of ethos across the two organisations before you move into some of the kind of practical.
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources, and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance, and research-based publications.
This week, listen to Ross McGill, founder of Teacher Toolkit, interview Toby Greeney, professor of education at the University of Nottingham and a seasoned researcher in school improvement. In today's podcast, some of the things we'll be discussing are the successes and failures of academisation, the link between vision, values and school improvement, and the similarities between corporate mergers and new schools joining a trust.
Hello everyone, this is Ross at Teacher Toolkit, the most influential blog on education in the UK. Today I am delighted to be joined by Toby Greeney. Toby is a professor of education at the University of Nottingham and has a wealth of experience researching school improvement. Hello Toby, how are you?
Hello Ross, I'm good, thank you, yes.
Thank you so much for joining me on my podcast. For listeners who are familiar with the show, they'll know that we kind of unpick the life of the person that I'm working with. And we'll come to that in a moment. But I want to start off with a kind of key question. Why school improvement?
So I guess it's evolved over time. I'm not only interested in school improvement. I'm interested in school leadership. How do school leaders kind of respond to policy, to other contextual changes and so on and so forth, and then how they work with colleagues to kind of enact improvement? And I guess that's come a lot of it over the years. I mean, I've done research kind of more in classrooms in terms of kind of pedagogy and student learning. But in 2006, I went to the National College for School Leadership. I was director of research and policy there, and had a great kind of 6-year period doing research, commissioning research, you know, working with school leaders around the country. And I think that's really where my interest really kind of coalesced around those areas.
So what was your first proper job?
I did a teaching English as a foreign language qualification and went and taught in Brazil for 2 years.
Okay, great.
In English schools there. And then I went for 2 years to China and taught in a university there that was did mainly on the kind of teacher training program, and was with VSO in China. So I did 4 years of teaching abroad, basically.
Okay, and masters and PhD kind of phase, what happened there?
Came back from China and did a master's in adult education. And at that time was thinking I would go back into international development and kind of work abroad. But then thought I'd go back to London for a year and ended up getting a job with a charity called Campaign for Learning. And from there, it just kind of, you know, I got married, we had 3 children and never left.
Great. And you've done quite a bit with the UCL Institute of Education. Can you give us a little kind of background synopsis into your kind of career and, research experiences in that phase of your life?
Yeah, sure. So Campaign for Learning, as I said, was the kind of job after the Manchester, and I was there for 7 years, did lots of really interesting things. That's where I really got interested in policy, but probably the thing that I was kind of most passionate about, most proud of in my time there, was running a large-scale action research program on learning to learn in schools. Working with schools in clusters, one cluster in Edmonton, one in Cheshire, one in Cornwall, over 3 years, working with Professor Steve Higgins, who's now at Durham. And that was great fun. So that kind of really got me interested in all of the kind of educational research aspect. From there, I went to the Design Council, spent 2 years working on school learning environments, and from there to the National College, 6 years there, and then left the National College after it had merged with the DfE. I kind of, you know, that was not what I wanted to be doing particularly, so I went to UCL as a professor, and for 5 years was running the what's kind of the London Centre for Leadership in Learning.
So a really fascinating kind of career, a bit of a jigsaw in some respects. What's lockdown been like for you in your work, you know, chair of education, you know, at Nottingham? How has it all been for you, and how has the university, or at least the education faculty, responded or adapted?
I'm very conscious my lockdown has not been as stressful as many people's. My teaching and research has continued. I've not really been in the building since March last year. I was teaching in classrooms.
Are all your own children beyond school age?
My children are, one's started university last autumn, so yeah. Kind of that was interesting.
Yeah,
and then the other two are at secondary school there, and so have been, you know, at home, homeschooling, or back at school. So it's been busy and different and difficult in its way, but yeah. You know, certainly in terms of work.
Have you found more time to write and read?
I have had more time to read and write, and, you know, collaboration, you know, talking to groups in different parts of the country and so on, you know, you can do in a 2-hour slot rather than spending the day traveling and so on. So in some ways it has freed some time, which has been really good.
Now, I'm just looking at your bio here on the your University of Nottingham page, and 50 journal articles, lots of book chapters, lots of reports. Can I put you in a corner and ask you for one particular piece of work that you're most proud of that you think has been a game changer?
I think I would choose, the study I did with Rob Higham called Hierarchy, Markets and Networks, where we looked at how schools in four different localities around the country are responding to the government's reforms underway since 2010. So kind of academies, teaching school alliances, all of the kind of system leadership stuff. And that, I think, you know, certainly it's been, in terms of my thinking, it's the project that's moved me on most fundamentally. Mm-hmm. I think it's had quite a big influence as well.
Fantastic. So let's get kind of into the details. You know, you've published a number of papers, you know, Hierarchy, Markets and Networks, and looking at that kind of self-improvement. And I know you'll be interested, much as I, the defragmentation, the marketization, populism, how schools have evolved, particularly over the last 10 years, the kind of academization structure. Could you just give us some general thoughts, and then we can maybe talk about a particular piece of research that you've conducted, and maybe also some of your kind of conclusions?
Yeah, sure. So with that study, Hierarchy, Markets, Networks, as I said, we looked at the schools, a representative sample of schools in four localities around the country, two that had high proportions of academies, two with low proportions of academies in 2014 when we started the study. We did a survey of head teachers. We did some statistical analyses of multi-academy trust impact and so on. So there's lots in there that I won't go into the detail of. I think what was interesting with that was, you know, there was this whole explosion of academies and this idea of a self-improving system that schools would collaborate and share knowledge and expertise, that mm-hmm. leaders would kind of work on behalf of the system. And there were lots of evidence in that study that schools did collaborate more over the course of that period, and that often that collaboration was really, really helpful to them and was, you know, supportive for teachers and so on and so forth. At the same time, what we conclude is that those networks, although they're more significant, more important, and often very powerful, they're kind of operating under the shadow of Hierarchy and Markets. So people are networking in order to get ready for the next Ofsted inspection. They're networking because there are all sorts of government incentives which kind of encourage or force them to network. And they're networking in partnerships that have to take account of the market. So, you know, who I collaborate with, where they are in the local.
So in terms of your kind of, you know, the local authority model that we're all familiar with to this academization model, you know, hubs spread out a little further, kind of general opinions on the different types?
So, you know, certainly local authorities weren't perfect. They were mixed and, you know, it's not about defending one or other model, in my view. I think there are advantages and disadvantages to each. Mm-hmm. I think the fragmentation of the system has, you know, what I see is, and I think this is true in other countries that have gone in this kind of direction as well, is that, you know, a good multi-academy trust, and they're not all good, but the ones that are more effective, you could argue, is able to build kind of collaborative structures across schools to develop a kind of shared culture, shared ways of working in ways which can be really powerful. Mm. The challenge, I think, is that within a locality, if you've got schools, you know, trusts that are then competing with each other, schools that are not in trusts, that are not supported because the local authority has pretty much collapsed, and all of those other kind of ramifications of the fragmentation, I think that can become very problematic.
Mm. And in terms of those, you know, the things that you researched, where it kind of works, could you just maybe just summarize some of the highlights, is it the culture, the leadership, demographics?
Available. So I did a study for the department with lots of other colleagues, but the Sustainable Improvement in Multi-School Group study that we published just before Christmas 2018. And we looked at multi-academy, it was multi-academy trusts, teaching school alliances, local authorities and school federations, but focusing on the multi-academy trust findings, which was the biggest part of the study. We looked at trusts in three groups, the above average performance over 3 years, average and below average, and by different size bands, small, medium, large. And I think the department thought that we were going to find that, you know, the above average performers are all doing it this way, the below average performers are all doing it that way. Mm-hmm. And if all of the below average performers would just do what the above average performers are doing, then everything would
be as simple as that.
That definitely wasn't what we found. You know, it was all, you know, lots of differences. And that was partly about the composition of the trust. You know, was it all converter academies? Was it primarily sponsored academies? All those kind of questions. But very briefly, I would say, in the medium and larger trusts that have kind of dealt with the growth challenges and started to build a more kind of coherent approach, we talk about the fact that there were two different, you know, broadly two different categories, some that were very improvement focused, mm-hmm. in quite a narrow way, some that had a broader purpose. And I think having that broader purpose, which brings you together, sometimes that was a faith ethos, sometimes it was about a particular kind of approach to curriculum or pedagogy, for example. Certainly that, I think, was important. Mm-hmm. I think those trusts that were more impressive were able to articulate how their kind of vision and values translated into distinctive approaches to school improvement. So they actually could kind of show the thread right through down to kind of what the experience of pupils was. And certainly the ways in which schools came together to work on those issues was quite distinctive. I think trust leaders, you know, have been in a difficult position. Often, you know, you're going from being the head of a single school into running suddenly a group of, you know, 5-10 schools. But I think the ones who are able to kind of metacognitively articulate how are we working as an organization, making that transparent, involving people in decision making so that it feels like a shared endeavor rather than a kind of overly hierarchical approach, and being really thoughtful about how are we moving knowledge around, because in a way the only advantage of being in this trust is that we can share knowledge and expertise more successfully than if we were, you know, 10 separate schools. And having a really clear theory of action for how you do that is really important.
So I'm going to ask you a loose question here, because I know as a researcher it's probably not framed very well, but has academisation raised standards? And I know we'd need to define standards, but if we just go for kind of general PISAs or exam league tables, all that type of stuff, is that a question you can answer?
So there have been lots of attempts to assess this, you know, people like John Adams, John Andrews at Education Policy Institute, Becky Francis did a series of studies looking particularly at impact on disadvantaged students. As part of the Hierarchy Markets Network study, we worked with a team at NFER and we looked at the impact of multi-academy trusts, not just academies. Overall, what all of that research shows is no, they haven't. You know, there's no discernible difference as a result of academisation. In our study, we found that small trusts were overall making a positive impact, whereas that then washes out. And by the time you got to the big trusts, so the 16 plus schools, they were overall making a negative impact.
Right.
And that was quite, you know, I'm sure the data will have moved on since then. So that would have reflected some of those big trusts, you know, the ones that were paused, one of which I know you know well. So I think things will have moved on since then, but I think definitely those early trusts that grew too fast really struggled.
So I guess if we think about those kind of smaller trusts, you know, where we could maybe say that they do improve standards, are there certain aspects that could be maybe, you know, we wouldn't want to replicate it, but could it be bottled in some respects and templated elsewhere?
I think I couldn't say this definitively. I mean, obviously, we looked at small trusts, small, medium and large when we did the study for the DfE. And we didn't, you know, definitely there is a degree to which you're a small trust, particularly if you're a kind of school-led successful school, is then sponsoring one or two other schools. There's a core team of people who've maybe worked together over, you know, many years. They trust each other. They have the right expertise and they get in there and they do the hard work of school improvement. Mm. That can work when it's two or three schools. The challenge is once it becomes five schools or 10 schools, you can't rely on that, everyone knowing each other, everyone having worked together over many years. And so you have to start to systematize it. So I think the ability to bottle that, the problem with that is that it doesn't actually work once you scale it. Mm-hmm. If it's all about kind of tacit practitioner knowledge being applied in one context, because it's not very replicable.
Sure. And then... you know, I'm actually writing an article about head teacher salary, and I know there's lots out there at the moment. And we know that certain trusts or large trusts, you know, pay, you know, what would be considered an enormous sum of cash for one person to lead a large number of schools. Is there any research at all that you're aware of, or anything that you've looked at in terms of yourself, the person at the top of the kind of multi-academy trust train, in terms of their effectiveness? Or what impact it might have, you know, if you pay someone off £1 million, you get the kind of Premier League manager, so to speak. Is there any kind of thing that you're aware of that kind of the right person at the top, the salary makes a difference?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, I know that we pay our head teachers, you know, at the top end worldwide, and our chief execs are paid, you know, a lot more than that even. The research on, you know, if we think of Monte Academy Trust as part of the middle tier, pretty much every system has a middle tier, and there is some research. Not, it's hard to do good research, and you know, it's not a kind of randomized control type research, but there is some research certainly that shows that the structure and the operations of the middle tier is really important. And potentially the leadership within that middle tier makes a difference to outcomes.
Just for listeners and perhaps teachers that aren't thinking as a researcher, could you just define the middle tier?
Yes, of course. So, I mean, basically it's whatever sits above schools, but below, you know, the National Department of Education. Brilliant. In England, traditionally it was local authorities. Now it's local authorities plus multi-academy trusts and so on. And also would include things like a teaching school alliance, arguably.
Yeah.
So that, all those different things that influence schools.
Yeah, the new teaching hubs have just been announced, haven't they? What are your experiences from this type of model overseas? Any insights from what works best across other parts of the world?
So one of the joys of lockdown certainly was writing a chapter for a handbook with a team in the United States, Josh Glazer and Meg Duff, and they're doing really interesting equivalent research into kind of charter management organizations, which are the equivalent of multi-academy trusts, and how they work with school districts, which would be the equivalent of local authorities. Mm-hmm. And there are a huge amount of read across in terms of kind of some of the dynamics of what's going on. I've just had an article has come out today in the School Leadership and Management Journal looking at multi-academy trusts and comparing them to mergers and acquisitions literature, so from the business and other kind of organisational development sectors. But that is part of a special issue, which also includes articles looking at the Netherlands as well as the United States. So there is certainly some parallel developments in other parts of the world, but overall I'd say that I talk quite a lot internationally, and mostly people kind of look at me in horror/surprise at what's been going on in England.
Okay, that's interesting. I'm just having a look at your paper, you know, Greeny and McGinty 2021, the structural integration and knowledge exchange. And just a quote from the abstract. You know, the key question facing MAT leaders is whether, where and how far to seek integration between schools. And you've mentioned that word consistency. Now, my experience of visiting schools, you know, particularly from a teaching and learning perspective, not many head teachers can confidently say they are consistent. And even if they get to a place, it's the challenges trying to hold on to that. Could you just briefly summarise this particular paper, and then if we can pop into the kind of consistency across MATs and the challenges that MAT leaders listening might face?
Yeah, sure. So this paper draws on that DfE study that I mentioned, the Sustainable Improvement in Multi-School Group study. Yeah. And what we do is we're looking particularly at where new schools join a trust, and comparing that to kind of the mergers and acquisitions in other sectors, which is often in kind of the business literature, where you've got two organizations coming together, where there's lots of research, you know, and it's important to say, you know, schools are not businesses and there are lots of differences, but I think there are some interesting lessons that we can kind of draw out and reflect upon in the education sector from all of this. One of those things is that, you know, most mergers and acquisitions fail, depending on how you define failure, but you know, there's a high level of failure in those M&As. And one of the big challenges with a merger is, or an acquisition, is kind of how do you create a shared culture? How do you move knowledge around between these two newly joined organizations? And one of the key findings for me is that it's about a kind of having a long view of how long that takes, probably starting more with what's called the sociocultural integration. So building the kind of trust, the shared kind of ethos across the two organizations before you move into some of the kind of practical.
Yeah, no, it's interesting.
Bringing together systems and processes. One of the things is that, you know, the role of the leader in the organization that is acquired, and do they continue to play a role in bridging between the two organizations is really key. Now, when we look at then where multi-academy trusts take over schools, we know that where it's a sponsored academy in particular, you tend to get very high levels of staff turnover. You don't tend to get those leaders being given a cross-trust role. You tend to get the trust imposing its knowledge and systems and processes on the newly joined school. So we're reflecting on that, the implications of all of that in the article.
Yeah, no, I've been in a, you know, you'll know that I've been in academies for 10 years, and at least two of those schools in that period were one transitioned to a large trust, you'll know EduTrust or EACT, and the latest one was Harris in my experience. And the things that you've said there are very, very familiar. If we could just come back to this consistency, what challenges Or what, you know, going back to that bottled approach, what do you see are the things that can be consistently applied? Is it just literally policy templates, staff contracts, those types of things that are rolled out? We
go into lots of detail on this, you know, in the article, but also in the original report. So, I mean, the department has been pressuring MAT leaders to standardize things. You know, there's this view that the high-performing trusts standardize everything, and therefore that's what you need to do in order to get improvement across the trust. And so we wanted to explore that in real detail in the research. And we asked, and then we did the national survey, all the case study work and so on. We used a consistent set of definitions around how much do you standardize things, do you try and align things, or do you give schools continuing autonomy? Mm-hmm. And we looked at it in three areas. In terms of kind of assessment and data, in terms of curriculum, and in terms of pedagogy. The finding, I mean, kind of lots of nuance to the finding, but the headline, again, which surprised the department, is that it was really a very small minority of trusts that were standardizing everything. Right. They were standardizing.
I didn't find that a surprise.
I'm sure you do. I mean, that is not the perception in the world. I mean, certainly standardizing on data and assessment was common.
Yeah.
Or aligning, and I'm kind of distinguishing between standardization and alignment being two different things. But, you know, having the same exam board, for example. You know, they tend to insist that, particularly where it's a sponsored academy, the kind of turnaround approach.
And what are your findings in terms of the teaching and learning practice, the pedagogy?
Well, on curriculum and pedagogy, it was much more so. It's a small group that was standardizing everything. Some of them were above average performers, some of them were below average performers, but you know, that kind of take, particularly in sponsored academies, that was particularly apparent. But then a much bigger group who were working to align practices, which is to say that they were kind of trying to bring people together to agree a shared understanding and a shared approach, but not always imposing it, and often then leaving it optional. You didn't absolutely have to adopt that approach if you wanted to do something different. And some of them using more kind of organic approaches, which I thought was interesting. So, you know, saying we have some, one trust had a commitment to character education. They had some clear principles which they'd agreed, and they kind of set out, this is what we think it looks like. They audited schools to understand what they were doing, but they didn't prescribe what schools did. They just said, we expect you to be doing something on character education. And the trust job was then to kind of learn from that, spread the learning around, make sure that people were continually reflecting on it and developing
it. Do you have any analysis on, you know, recruitment, you know, the kind of expenditure, you know, value for money, how much taxpayers' cash is wasted, for example, on the transition to academisation, et cetera, et cetera?
We didn't look at that in that study. If you want that data, so there's obviously the study that Sarah Bubb did looking at the costs of the middle tier, where they compare academies and local authorities, which came out a couple of years ago. There's a paper by Peter Davies and Tom Perry and people where they look at kind of standardisation in the back office aspects of multi-academy trusts, but we were looking at the kind of school improvement.
And if I just return to kind of COVID and lockdown, I guess from, you know, us all sitting at home, what have you been your observations of how local authorities or multi-academy trusts have responded to the, you know, lockdown one a year ago, so to speak? Any kind of good practice?
I should say I'm on the board of a multi-academy trust here in Nottingham, and so kind of I'm closest to that story, where, you know, the feedback from heads, from teachers, is that it's been really helpful to be part of a group of schools, which has helped with all of the kind of extra workload that this has caused, and you know, has helped to kind of create a structure to work within. And my sense is that, you know, lots of other people who are working in trusts, you know, have valued the fact that that's given them a structure to work within. I've done some other, you know, I've been doing other evaluation work with schools that are not in trusts, but that are in different types of networks, and some of them have really struggled. So I think it's been a really tricky time for everyone. I think being in a well-run trust, you know, can be really helpful at this time. One thing that I think is really interesting, I mean, one of the things I'm really interested in studying is where you're getting localities where local authority, multi-academy trusts, all of these different players are coming back together and are forming local partnerships, which are then saying, well, actually, here in Sheffield, we're going to collaborate and we're going to have a shared CPD program. And so
I was going to ask, is this what kind of drives you, that, you know, policies, school improvement, you know, the kind of hallmark of success is, you know, I was going to ask what next for you. I'm picking up that's your motivating factor, trying to unpick that collaboration as a hallmark for success.
Absolutely. So, you know, a book I'm writing at the moment with a colleague in New Zealand, Annalise Camp, is called Leading Educational Networks. I'm really interested in kind of networks, how they work, how we lead them, what difference they make. And looking at that in four countries. So we've done case studies in England and New Zealand, but also we draw on Singapore and Chile, and we look at it through four different theoretical lenses to try and just kind of get into a lot more detail than anyone's done until now in terms of the leadership of networks. That's a big area of interest. These locality partnerships in England, I think, are really interesting because it's kind of, can we knit back together a level? I think place is really important, and knitting back a level of coherence in our fragmented system and how that works, I think, is something that is understudied at the moment.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. Now, I didn't warn you at the start of the show, Toby, that you know, throughout our conversation, I'm kind of picking up and writing kind of keywords, and I'm going to start to I kind of hit our 20-minute barrier where listeners tend to tune out. So to try and keep everyone engaged, I'm going to throw a little kind of Timmy Mallet quick quiz at you, and you can't pause or hesitate. And I'll see if I can catch you off guard, so to speak. So I'll start with an interesting one on your Twitter bio, a dismal allotmenteer. So what are you growing in your allotment at the moment?
So dismal that I'm afraid I've given it up.
No.
I'm into just trying to keep the garden in some order at the moment.
And what's an unthanks groupie?
The unthanks are a fantastic two sisters and band from Northumberland, folk music, and right. I have followed them here, there and everywhere. They did an online festival a few weeks ago.
Absolutely gorgeous. Can you pick up a musical instrument? What would it be?
Oh, goodness, no. I'm more of a singer than a player.
Okay, and if you, I'm going to assume you're doing the best job in the world, but what's your off-the-wall abstract career that you never had? Deep-sea diver or something wacky?
Yeah, actually, I did want to be a deep-sea diver when I was there. I didn't think there was any money in it, so I was going to be a deep-sea diver on the oil rigs. In order to earn money, I was going to work on a building site.
All right, great. Deep-sea diving. And what project are you working on today? What's on your desk?
On my desk today, I am trying to get on with a chapter of that book on networks.
Okay, great. What book are you reading for fun? Fiction, if possible.
I'm reading The Silk Roads by Peter Frankopan, which is fascinating. So it's non-fiction, but it's still fun for me, history. And then I just finished Utopia Round Avenue by David Mitchell, which was fantastic.
Right, okay, great. You know, you've mentioned lots of places, Chile, Brazil, Singapore. Where's your favourite spot in the world?
Other than Nottingham, New Zealand, I loved. I did a fellowship in Canterbury at the University of Canterbury a couple of years ago, and that was fantastic.
Right, so you have really been around the place. If we had 24 hours together in Nottingham, where would you take us, you know, kind of show the sights of the city?
Oh, I'd take you for dog walks in the countryside, kind of around Nottingham and places like Wollaston Park, which are great. That's where Batman was filmed.
Right, where would we go for dinner? Square.
Yeah. Saturday night and Sunday morning.
Where would be the dinner spot would go to? Would it be at home or would it be there?
It would be Kyal, which is an Indian in town.
Very nice. What's your piece of advice for teachers who want to get into research? You know, but they're time poor, they're really interested in all this kind of dialogue that's immersing. What's your top tip?
Oh, well, I'd say, you know, read the teacher toolkit blogs and so on. I mean, I think there's lots of really good, you know, and helpful, accessible summaries and kind of, you know, think pieces about research, which can get you into then reading further. And that's the way to start. And then, you know, sign up for a master's at the University of Nottingham.
Oh, there you go. There's the plug. What's your greatest career achievement to date? There was a bit of a hesitation there.
That's definitely a hesitation. There's lots of things I've kind of proud of having done. I mean, certainly the work we did at the National College was, you know, it wasn't just me, it was all of us. But there was a, you know, I think the college was a powerful force in the system.
Now, listeners can't see that we see each other. And I know some of your pictures have no beard. Have we got a lockdown beard going on here?
Yes. I think my wife can't wait for the end of lockdown in that respect.
Fantastic. For any multi-academy trusts listening or head teachers going into a multi-academy trust leadership position for the first time, any top recommendations for them?
So I would say, I mean, I've been talking about when I've been doing talks recently, I've been focusing on this. The question now is that there are some big challenges for schools. It is about, you know, taking this opportunity. You know, clearly we're all knackered. There's all the kind of logistical, practical stuff to get on with. So I'm not saying this is easy, but I think we've got some big challenges and some big opportunities to rethink some things, to think about, for example, you know, what do we take from what we've learned about online digital learning now that we're back in the classroom to really make it more powerful, more successful? How do we rethink the curriculum in order to kind of really support recovery and so on and so forth? So I would say, think about your decision-making approach. Schools tend to be very busy places. People tend to work very quickly and to make the best quick decision. good decision making does require more consideration, more involvement of multiple stakeholders, multiple voices. There's some good research on this, which, you know, we can follow up on.
Yeah.
But the point is, what the research on, so McDuff is doing a really interesting study of schools in New York and how they've responded to lockdown. Mm-hmm. And she'd been tracking them for a couple of years prior to lockdown. So then her data is informed by that earlier work. And what she's finding is that schools that already had higher capacity, more effective, more trust, cultures of trust and collaboration and so on, were better at then responding to lockdown, consulting people, making well-considered decisions, yeah, putting people together. So that kind of, you know, thinking about how you do that now that we're all tired and trying to just get back to normal is a really important thing for me.
Next question, Toby. What's your family party trick? You got a silly dad there.
I was singing ridiculous songs and doing actions, probably.
You've been doing the sea shanties, I told you, in lockdown.
the unthanks are, so I'll sing along with them if needs be.
Are you a brown sauce or a ketchup man?
Ketchup.
Next question, who would you recommend I interview next and why?
Well, I know you're interested in cognitive load theory and all of that stuff. And so I was talking yesterday to Tom Perry, who's currently at Birmingham, just about to move to Warwick. And he's coming to the end of a systematic review for the EEF on all of that.
Tom Berry or Tom Perry?
Tom Perry.
Tom Perry. I shall check him out. And then, you know, where can listeners read your research or connect with you online, Toby? What links?
So University of Nottingham's site has kind of links to publications and so on Twitter. I'm at Toby Greeny.
Great. Thank you, Toby. And once lockdown ends and we're all in a safer space, what's the first thing you're going to do outside in the real world?
Go on holiday to Scotland.
Oh, there. I would like to come along to that. My final question, Toby, a bit of a kind of philosopher one here. What would you hope to be your legacy?
A more rounded appreciation of leadership in context, culture and the wider aspects of leadership that are hard to study, but really important.
There you go. So thank you, Toby. Thank you, listeners. You're listening to Teacher Toolkit. I've been chatting with Toby Greeny, Professor of Education at the University of Nottingham. Thank you very much, Toby.
Not at all. Thank you.
Very, very interesting and fascinating. Thank you for your time.
Cheers. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.